Hey, listeners, we're nearing the end of our 15th anniversary fundraising campaign, and we need your help to meet our goal. This campaign offers you a chance to win a unique food and music experience in one of the most exciting cities in America. Here's how it works. Donate to HRN and you'll be entered to win dinner for two and two tickets to a concert in one of eight amazing cities: New York, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, Nashville, Las Vegas, Charleston, Ardmore, Pennsylvania, and Asheville. All donations support our work educating food system storytellers. And when you donate, you can choose one of those cities and you'll be entered to win dinner and two tickets to a show. So help us reach our goal and enter to win dinner and a show in the city of your choice. Check out heritageradionetwork.org/15 to donate and enter to win today. That's heritageradionetwork.org/15. Thank you.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Erica Wise, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and today we have a guest in studio, which hardly ever happens, but with me is the one and only Marion Nessel, the Paulette Goddard Professor at the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. She has been on this show many times, and she's been on the network many times. She is also the author, in case you don't know, of Food Politics, of Safe Food, of Pet Food Politics, What to Eat, Feed Your Pet Right, and Why Calories Count. The latter two she wrote with Professor Malda Nesheim from Cornell. She is a frequent speaker at multitude of events, and most recently, she was at the Milan Food Expo in Italy, which opened a couple of weeks ago, partly organized the U.S. Pavilion by our own Mitchell Davis from Taste Matters. So welcome to the show, Marion. Thanks for coming back.
Happy to be here.
It's great to have you. It's great to see you. It's been a long time because you were on sabbatical this semester, so you were
traveling
out in Berkeley, and you were traveling, and you were writing a book.
Mm-hmm. And coming book out in is, October.
What is it?
Soda Politics, Taking on Big Soda and Winning.
Oh boy.
First week in October.
I know the pins are in the voodoo doll right now. I'm surprised you haven't been struck with an unnameable malady from
I'm
that.
I'm just giving facts.
Just giving facts, as only you can, Marion.
It's a very big book.
I bet it's a big book. You've been working on this for quite a while, yeah. I know, yeah.
It's so they're thinking it's going to be around 550 pages.
Wow.
So it's being published by Oxford University Press's Encyclopedia Division, and that's why, I think.
Oh, wow. Well, I look forward to that. And, of course, you'll be back here to talk about it.
I certainly hope so.
You certainly will. But tell us about the Milan Expo. You were a speaker at one point there, and you toured the expo. And actually, if people want to learn more, they can go to Marion's blog, Food Politics. But tell us what you thought about it.
Well, it's hard to know what to think about it. It's enormous. Yeah. And it has pavilions that are enormous that represent many, many, many countries in the world have their own.
Sure.
I mostly hung out at the United States Pavilion because I wanted to see what Mitchell was up to.
Yeah.
The James Beard Foundation won the contract for running the American Pavilion.
Amazing.
And so he's there until the end of October, sort of keeping an eye on things and trying to make it work in Italy, which is challenging.
I can imagine.
But it got finished on time. It's beautiful. And it's enormous, and it's a boardwalk. They actually used the wood from the Coney Island boardwalk that had to be taken up because of Hurricane Sandy, and they took that wood and recycled it into the boardwalk through the pavilion.
Wow.
And the pavilion has a couple of things that are absolutely amazing. One is a wall of water that has designs on it. I still don't know how they did that, but it's particularly fabulous at night where you can watch all these different patterns. And then it has this wall of vegetables planted vertically. It's a vertical garden.
It's a vertical garden, yeah.
That undulates so that the panels that these, that the plants are stuck into open and close in a regular order, and it looks like this big wave going through, and it's gorgeous.
And the undulation is how the plants get their light, they all get the same or is that just a decorative feature?
I think it's decorative. I don't think it has a particular function. But the entire sort of message of the pavilion is that Americans don't just do industrial agriculture. Americans do artisanal food, and they do sustainable agriculture. They do organics. They care about diet and health. You go in, and the first thing you see is a video of President Obama talking about how important food is for how everybody should have access to a nutritious, healthy, affordable diet,
right,
and how we all need to be working together to create sustainable food systems. And then it goes on from there.
Wow. And there is a Coca-Cola pavilion, I believe?
There is a separate Coca-Cola pavilion.
It's not part of the U.S. pavilion?
Not part of the U.S. pavilion at all, although it's not too far from it. No, PepsiCo is a sponsor of the United States pavilion. And so the food trucks, every pavilion has to have food.
Yes.
And the American pavilion does this through food trucks.
Uh-huh.
And it has food trucks sort of parked in the back of the pavilion. And they have lobster rolls and shrimp rolls and hamburgers and hot dogs and Pepsi and Lay's potato chips because PepsiCo was a sponsor. But the Coca-Cola Pavilion, which I was very interested in because of the soda book coming out in the fall, you wait online and you register and you get a little chip on a keychain that you use to sort of open up all of the exhibits, and the exhibits are personalized. So the exhibits say, "Hello, Marion. We'd like to talk to you about our efforts in sustainability and our efforts in picking up waste and our efforts in doing all of these things to fix problems that they caused in the first place."
Yeah, exactly. Well, did they have a solution for obesity?
The solution for obesity is more exercise is what they're usually, it's very much,
so they do have
it's
that.
Very much a move kind of thing. And there's a platform on which you can
jump
and do those kinds of things. Right.
Oh, my God.
They also had a gift shop. And that was kind of amazing, too, because they had purses and bags made out of flip tops.
Yes.
From the cans. And it didn't say anything about who was making them or how much the people who made them were paid.
Well, it's probably slave labor in Vietnam.
They sold for a couple of hundred euros.
Wow.
I mean, this is really high-end stuff.
Wow. I didn't even know they made flip-tops anymore that come out of the can. These must be archaic.
Well, they may
be. Flip-tops.
They may be. I don't know.
I noticed in Vietnam, speaking of clothing made out of soda cans, when I went to see the tunnels in Cu Chi, which is, you know, the vast underground network of tunnels that the Viet Cong lived in for some of them up to 8 years. And they, for some reason, had many, many products made out of old soda cans, including hats and purses and vests.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the feeling that there's a bit of an industry in that down in Vietnam. And that's probably where they had that made.
It's possible.
For this thing. And
it
I'm
didn't
sure they
say,
didn't pay those workers any 200 euros a bag.
Yeah, it didn't say.
So you you also gave a speech at the pavilion. What was what was the subject of your talk?
It was a version of the standard food politics talk that I often give, but it was very much focused on what the American Pavilion was doing and trying to do, and how you know, my sort of current theme is that I think we need to bring agriculture and health policy together, and this was one of the things that I thought the pavilion was trying to do.
Yeah.
Was to say that if you have a sustainable food system, that's going to be healthier, not only for the planet, but it's also going to be healthier for people.
Right.
And I thought a lot of the exhibits in the American Pavilion made that point.
Right. You know, I think it's great that they did this, but in a way, I can't. Of course, I have not been there, and I certainly don't mean to, you know, cast aspersions. But just the, you know, the elephant in the room is our agricultural system and is what we export as an agricultural model and as a, you know, food model. And so I think it's great that we're showing our sort of greener aspects, but given what a niche business all of the sort of artisanal products are and things like that, it's like, you know, I feel sort of I don't know, as if it's a little bit of a greenwashing of the American food system.
Well,
that
may
makes
be.
Me uncomfortable.
It may be, but I was also giving lectures for the State Department while I was there, and that may require some explanation on its own.
And you are not a spy.
And
know
the
that.
Explanation that I was given was that the State Department wants people to understand that Americans speak with different voices.
Uh-huh.
And that there are many voices, and there isn't just one way of looking at things. So I was there to give kind of an alternative look at some of the things we were talking about. It's not the first time I've spoken for the State Department in Italy, actually. I was there once before, and I gave a very fancy named lecture at the Food and Agriculture Organization. It was the George McGovern annual lecture on World Food Day. And at the end of my talk, the then ambassador to, we have an ambassador to the Food and Agriculture Organization, got up after my talk and through very clenched teeth pointed out to the audience that I did not speak for the American government. And so I was very surprised to be invited back, but I was invited back, and I had a very good time giving talks. I met a lot of really interesting people there.
Oh, I bet you did. That's thrilling. So, Mary, when you travel, do you get to, like, go look at everyone's food systems? I mean, I imagine that is a large part of when you're invited to go somewhere. I know you've visited a lot of pork farms, for instance,
yes.
Denmark. And, you know, like, I mean, I can't think of any better gig than being allowed to just, like, cruise around and look at people's agricultural systems.
Yeah, this was not an agricultural trip. This was a city trip.
Yeah.
I did meet with a very large organic food company in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to a lot of people who were involved in a lot of activities. But the piece of the whole thing that just blew me away the most was something that's being held in conjunction with the Milan Food Expo, which is an enormous exhibit of food art at the Triennial Museum in Milan. And I've been to a lot of food art exhibits. This one had everything you have ever seen anywhere, and it would take days just to go through it on its own because it's so big.
Wow.
And because it's got so many videos and movie clips.
And is it from food art from around the world, obviously?
Oh, it's everywhere. They had posters from the American World War II that I had never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
A particularly fabulous one on corn that I had not seen before. They had American video clips. They had American objects. They had they came from everywhere. It's just an extraordinary exhibit.
Mm.
And if anybody is going to the Food Expo in Milan, you have to leave time for this.
Yeah, it sounds absolutely amazing. I hope it will be up for the whole duration.
Till the end of October.
Okay, great. Great. A couple of the things that I saw on your blog really interested me because, I mean, you did illustrate your trip so lavishly with photographs. It was great. I mean, it's definitely worth a look at Food Politics if you're not a regular reader to go look at Marion's posts about the Food Expo because it's just fascinating. But you pointed out this kind of ticker tape exhibit of about food commodities, which really struck me. And commodities, you know, the commodity market and food commodities is something that doesn't really get discussed a lot in terms of food policy, at least on my level.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it has such a tremendous impact on food pricing around the world. And I don't think that a lot of people, at least I never until now, until, you know, the last few years, made the connection between trading on Wall Street and
prices. You should put Fred Kaufman on your list of people to interview. He's written a terrific book about it.
Oh, I would love to. So one of the things I noted down the various things that it said, the food sector reality versus abstraction. What did they mean by that?
I didn't have the faintest idea. Except I thought that what they probably meant was that you have this idea of how the food system works.
Right.
And in theory, it works one way, and in practice, it works a very different way. way. And they were talking about the in-practice ways that it doesn't work very well. And, you know, it supports corporations. It doesn't support individuals. And the trading of commodities has had just an enormous effect on food prices throughout the world.
Yes.
It's treating food as if it were some kind of widget.
Yes.
And betting on what its prices are going to be. The use of food to grow, to make ethanol, fuel for cars, has had an enormous effect on the ability of poor people to buy food and have enough money to take care of food. So these are the kinds of issues that were discussed in that, and that Fred Kaufman talks about in his book.
I'm definitely going to read that book and then invite him onto the show. Well, that talks. That's exactly what the next entry was: extreme price volatility is a threat to food security, and that's what you're saying there. And I think, you know, many people pointed to the Arab Spring as a, in some ways, as a response to escalated food prices during the the Great Recession, and also that was largely due, I think, to ethanol prices and corn and all of the rest of that. Commodity markets went crazy.
An astonishing 40% of United States corn production goes to ethanol, not even food
not
for
even
animals.
Livestock.
And the, you know, the livestock producers are furious about it because it raises the cost of their feed, and the really amazing part about it is that from an energy standpoint, it's practically a wash. It takes almost as much energy to turn corn into ethanol than you get out of it in ethanol. So this is something that's going to have to change.
Yes. And, you know, they talked about switching up the product from corn to like switchgrass or sorghum or, you know, a multitude of other crops. And yet somehow that has not happened.
That's not happening.
And I guess that can be attributed to the subsidies that come for corn and soy in the farm bill?
Part of it. I mean, it's just wonderful for farmers to grow as much corn as they possibly can, and this
there's
is
an
a market,
endless market
for
it. Yeah.
Yeah. And the alcohol lobby, the ethanol lobby, has a lot of power in Congress and convinced Congress that they could build all these plants and do all this, and this would be wonderful for
And yet it has
fuel.
Not happened. The ethanol plants have not grown in response, particularly.
Well, at this point, everybody's looking at trying to change the system because it's not doing anybody any good except
the corn farmers.
Except the corn farmers and the ethanol producers.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. There was another bullet point. Lack of transparency and profits for a few intensify inequality in food distribution. I guess what struck me about this was... First of all, yes, we know that. But like, what were they? I mean, and then the next one was new rules are needed for agricultural governance. Well, duh.
I don't
understand what they're trying to achieve.
Well, you have to understand
with
the
this.
Context of this. The context of this was the first pavilion that you go into when you do the long walk from the subway station. And you go into this pavilion, and it starts with the history of the history of world agriculture. And you go through these rooms in which they show the increasing industrialization of agriculture. And then you come into this absolutely enormous room in which there is this enormous ticker tape wall with these slogans coming through in English and Italian and ticker tape of the price of commodities at places all over the world. It's hard to explain how big this thing is and how impressive it is and how you just sit there gap-jawed, you know, with your mouth open looking at it.
Yeah.
And then I took pictures as quickly as I could on my cell phone to try to get what they were saying. And I don't know how clearly they're translated from the Italian.
Yeah.
But the point is very clear that this is all about money.
Yes. And what struck me also about this is that this particular section of these, you know, these little slogans that came up or whatever you want to call them, they pertain so acutely to American food system. But I'm wondering if they are meant to reflect the global system? Because, I mean, for instance, the Europeans are so much more careful about their food than we are. I mean, refusing to, you know, use genetically modified organisms and all of the different chemicals that we put into our livestock sector, which they will not use or touch or buy from us. And I just felt like this was so directly related to the American food system, as if the American food system has almost become kind of the, I mean, I guess it is, right? The biggest elephant in the room. I mean, what else?
Well, I would imagine it was hard to find out who had done it.
Yeah.
And I never did find out who had done it. When I went online to try to figure out, it's the United Nations Pavilion, but it was very, it was not clear to me where this particular ticker tape exhibit came from.
Yeah.
Or who had done it, except that it was enormously impressive.
Right, because I don't see these problems in Spain, for instance.
Well, the farms are smaller.
They're small. I mean, nobody else has an industrialized system that we do, nor do we have the... Nobody else really has the lobbying apparatus that we have, do they?
Or the...
Please correct me.
They don't have the lobbying... Well, they do have the lobbying apparatus, but it doesn't have the structure that receives the lobbying apparatus in so welcoming a way as ours.
Right.
So that the lobbyists are present in all of these European countries. I heard a lot about that from a lot of people, but they don't pay any attention to it, or they don't have to pay attention to it to the same level that we do, because their elections aren't funded in the same way as ours, and they are not allowed to have unlimited corporate funding,
right,
anonymous,
right,
in their election campaigns.
Right.
As we now are, thanks to the Supreme Court decisions.
Yes. Yeah. It's just, it goes right back to that, doesn't it?
Money.
It really does. It just goes right back to that, and really just that particular Supreme Court decision.
Two decisions, Citizens United and McCutcheon. But the...
I don't know what McCutcheon is, Mary.
Well, that's the one that allowed secrecy.
Oh.
It's the one that was a later one.
That's the
point. But so that this exhibit, the point of this exhibit was to show that food as a commodity, you know, what the whole Food Expo was supposed to be about is solving world hunger. And this was the Zero Hunger Pavilion. And growing food sustainably so that it won't be quite so hard on climate change. And these kinds of things. So these are kind of... progressive, if that's the word. I mean, they're progressive goals, and forward thinking, and that's what the whole thing was supposed to be about.
Yeah.
But at the, you know, and I didn't see in my 3 days there, I only scratched a tiny fraction of what's there.
Wow.
So I can't claim to speak for the whole thing, but it was very hard to know at the end what kind of messages people would be taking away about these issues.
Very interesting. And did you have a chance to go look at some of the other countries' pavilions?
I did.
Yeah? And what were their messages?
Well, their messages ranged from, this is the kind of agriculture, these are the agricultural products that we're producing. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of that.
Of course.
There were lots and lots of the pavilions had raised beds of one kind or another where they were growing vegetables. That was all over the place, sometimes on walls, sometimes on roofs. Roofs, sometimes just in boxes. Many of them had stories about how the farmers were growing food and how their... I sat and watched the Argentinian movies. Everything's in video. So if you're not a lover of videos, it gets old very fast.
Yeah.
But so everybody did everything with videos. And the you know, what makes the American Pavilion a little easier that way is that there's 120 college students dressed in adorable Brooks Brothers uniforms who are sort of helping you look at the exhibits and talking about the exhibits, and they're terrific. And some of the other pavilions had people who were explaining, but mostly it's videos.
Yeah.
To handle the enormous crowds that are going through. So even in the first 2 weeks, the American Pavilion was getting 20 to 25,000 visitors a day.
And who were those visitors? European Union?
Well, they're Italians at this point.
Right.
And school groups.
Right.
And Italian school groups, mostly. It's still early on.
Sure.
And maybe there will be more international visitors later on, but they're getting 200 or 300,000 visitors a day on the weekends. I mean, it's enormous.
That's incredible. Well, we should take a short break, right, Jack? We will be right back with Dr. Marion Nessel. And we're going to be talking about the 2015 dietary guidelines that were released recently. I'm sure she has something interesting to say about that.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're on the Heritage Radio Network. In the studio with me today is Dr. Marion Nessel from the New York University School of Food Studies. And we are going to talk now about the 2015 USDA guidelines, dietary guidelines that just came out. There was a lot of pushback on those when they came out.
Can I be pedantic?
Yes, please.
Yeah, there were There were two not quite correct things in what
that
you
I just
said.
Yes.
One is like they're not out yet.
Oh, that's true. The final version is not out.
They're not out yet, and it's not USDA. It's USDA and Health and Human Services.
Thank you.
And these are critically important distinctions because the guidelines are based on the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee report, but the agencies turn them into the guidelines.
I see.
So let the politics begin.
Indeed. And they have, because
they
you told me in the car, they had received something like 29,000 comments.
Mm-hmm.
There was an open comment period, which closed only a few days ago, I understand. Mm-hmm. They actually had to extend it because of the pushback, largely from the meat industry, which literally went crazy because of, well, there were a number of quotes that would have made them go crazy, but here is the one that I feel was probably the most germane in that sense. They advised that adults follow diets, quote, lower in red and processed meat.
Ah!
And lower in lower in sugar sweetened foods and beverages and refined grains. So you can imagine that the meat industry, NCBA, came out right away. Stop the presses. You can't, you know, this can't go forward. We want the comment period to be extended. What science are you basing this on? And so forth and so on. It's hard to imagine that the snack industry and the soda industry didn't do the same thing. So I was hoping you'd be able to fill me in on their response.
Well, that's not all the meat industry did. The meat industry went to Congress and got 60 senators to sign a letter saying, we don't like this. and now they've got Congress writing letters to the Health and Human Services and USDA saying, we want to know how you're going to deal with the 29,000 comments.
Yeah.
What's your plan for dealing with them? Meaning, we want to know and we want to watch as you deal with those comments. So that's going to be interesting. And then Vilsack, Secretary Tom Vilsack of USDA, has addressed two conventions of meat producers so far. And in the first one, he compared the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee to three-year-olds. He said, they're just like my three-year-old granddaughter. She can't color within the lines. I have to color within the lines. And then he gave another speech to meat producers saying sustainability should not be part of the dietary guidelines.
Yes, that made the papers.
They both did.
Yeah.
They both did.
Which is just an astonishing remark.
Yeah, and it's not up to him because there are two agencies involved. And as it turns out, the lead agency on this one is Health and Human Services. Mm-hmm. That may make a difference.
I don't know anything about the Health and Human Services Agency. Who is on that agency that we should
well,
be
it's in the office
aware of?
It's in the Office of Disease Prevention and Health Promotion, and mm-hmm. I don't know who the players are.
Really?
Particularly, you hear much more about USDA than HHS, but one of the reasons why it's joint is to try to keep a lid on USDA.
That's right. Well, to try to shield them from the flack, right?
Oh, from the flack.
I mean, amazing.
Yeah. This is an agency that is issuing dietary guidelines for the American public and dealing with subsidies.
And it's funded by the agricultural
And it's, you know, its main purpose is to promote American industrial agriculture. So it's got a problem.
It does have a problem. What do you think of Tom Vilsack? I thought I was all full of hope when he came in to... I'm so disappointed.
Yeah,
personally.
I really loved his coming in and saying that what he really wanted to do was to revitalize and reinvigorate and repopulate rural America. I thought that was so smart and such a good thing to do. Well, how do you do that? You do that by bringing in smaller farmers.
Right.
That's what you do. Farmers bring their families. Families require schools. Schools open. You need you need
services.
Restaurants to feed them. You need
exactly.
all this stuff. You revitalize rural America. It didn't happen.
No, it did not happen.
And so I assume he's disappointed about that, but I don't really know.
I feel like there was a real... He just kind of dropped that ball.
Well, I think he got kicked in the teeth. And then,
I never
you know, I'll give
really
one
advocated.
I'll give one example of it.
Okay.
Where he tried to do a detente between GMO crop producers and the organic industry.
Right.
And there were meetings in which the groups got together to try to figure out some way in which there could be coexistence, peaceful coexistence.
Yeah.
And the growers of genetically modified crops said, we don't have to do this. Goodbye.
Right.
And that was the end of it.
Wow.
So he got kicked in the teeth on that one. So I don't really know. I mean, I was heard that the White House was not particularly happy with the statements that he made about the dietary guidelines, but that's rumor and gossip, and I can't.
And you don't trade in those?
Not very often.
No.
I certainly don't write about it because it's, I don't have a reference.
Right. You know. Exactly. Here was another thing that struck me in the executive summary, which, by the way, anyone can read. This is all
online.
It's really easy to find.
Transparent.
Yep.
What happens next will not be transparent.
Right.
But this
because that happens behind closed doors when they actually write the guidelines, the final version, and go through the 29,000 comments.
Yeah, we will never know how that happened.
Yeah, we'll never know how much money changes hands over that.
Can't wait to see it.
Yeah. Anyway, so here's another statement that struck me as quite interesting. The diet quality, no matter where the food is obtained, the diet quality of the U.S. population does not meet recommendations for vegetables, fruit, dairy, or whole grains, and exceeds recommendations leading to overconsumption for the nutrients, sodium, saturated fat, and the food components, refined grains, solid fats, and added sugars. And I'm thinking to myself, we know this. I mean, why is this? I don't understand. Like, when you're creating guidelines like this, and I know you've worked on committees.
I was on one of these in 1995.
You know, why is stating the obvious an acceptable form of communication when what you're really looking for is to, I mean, what struck me as I read through all this stuff is, you know, how it's all about what we need to do, we should do, we have to do. And then the federal government is somehow intrinsically involved in those need to, would to, should to, have tos. And yet there is no actual, you know, political will to engage the government in public health. And I think that's the thing that is so like.
Well, let's back up a little bit. What are the dietary guidelines? First of all, they're the middle step in a three-stage process.
Okay.
This is going to get very wonky, and I'm
That's
sorry.
That's good. You
and
know I'm a
sorry.
Geek.
I'm sorry about this.
I love that.
So first of all, there's something called dietary reference intakes, what used to be the recommended dietary allowances, which are standards of nutrient intake for the population.
Mm-hmm.
Those come first, and they were done 10 or 15 years ago. They're woefully out of date, but nobody wants to put the money into updating them.
Yeah.
So we're stuck with them. The dietary guidelines are supposed to take the dietary reference intakes and turn them into food-based recommendations. for the general population, right, in a report that is designed for policymakers, not for the general public.
Yeah.
So the general public is never supposed to see these. And believe me, the general public doesn't see these.
Right.
They don't see them. And then the third step is to take the dietary guidelines and turn that into a food guide for the general public. And that's where the old pyramids were. And now,
right,
choose my plate,
right,
is the current version of that. So presumably the guidelines will be, which by order of Congress have to come out every 5 years. And we're in the middle of the 2015 ones right now. And then probably sometime in 2016, there'll be a new food guide.
Right.
So the principles are important. The dietary guideline principles are important because they govern what we're supposed to be doing with food assistance programs, with nutrition education, and the food industry takes them very seriously. Mm-hmm. Because if you say eat lean meat or don't eat red meat,
yeah,
the meat industry goes berserk.
As we saw.
If you say don't drink sugar-sweetened beverages, the soda industry is going to have a big headache over this and try to do what it can to get it changed, but the soda industry is running scared these days, and hence the title of my book, parenthesis, and winning.
And winning, yeah.
They think it's because of health advocacy, and I do too. So that's sort of the context for this. And the process for producing the guidelines is that a committee of nutritionists reads the literature or reviews the literature and writes a very lengthy research report.
Uh-huh.
650 pages. That's the thing that's online.
Yeah.
You read the executive,
yeah,
summary. It goes on and on and on.
It does.
For another 600 pages. And then the agencies now take that huge report and turn it into something that hopefully will be simpler and easier to understand. Now, when I was on the committees wrote the guidelines, but that stopped in 2005. Mm. During the Bush 2 administration.
What a surprise.
Where they wanted control over what it said. So this will be a very politicized process,
mm-hmm,
in a way, except that it's under huge scrutiny because of the fight over it.
Now,
yeah, what this committee did, this Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, did something that had never been done before, and that was they mentioned the S word, sustainability.
Yeah.
And what they were trying to do was to do what I've been arguing for years, which is to link agricultural policy to health policy.
Right.
Yay.
Right.
Cheers. How wonderful that they did that. And their recommendation makes it very clear that a plant-based diet is healthiest for people.
Yes.
And guess what? A plant-based diet is healthiest for the planet, too.
That's right.
And we would all be better off if we were eating less meat, not no meat.
Right.
Just less meat.
Right.
But less meat is bad for business, and there you have it.
Yeah, and there you have it. And there it will probably stop. And between that and the soda lobby, you know, it's hard to imagine that sugar and meat are not going to remain pretty much where they are in terms of what you're supposed to have, the percentage of your diet.
Oh, I think they'll go down. I certainly
hope so.
Certainly the sugar... The sugar is under so much pressure right now,
yeah,
that they may actually have to come out with a percentage,
mm-hmm,
10% of calories, no more than 10% of calories from added sugars,
right,
which is actually what the recommendations in the dietary guidelines have been forever, but never stated like that.
I see. Interesting. Well, I you know, the whole thing about public policy and expecting the government to fund and participate in these matters of public health reminded me, as I told you in the car, of this piece that I read yesterday by Adam Gopnik about trains in the wake of the Philly train crash. And this, here's a quote from that. It said, "The reason we don't have beautiful new airports and efficient bullet trains is not that we have inadvertently stumbled upon stumbling blocks. It's that there are considerable numbers of Americans for whom these things are simply symbols of a feared central government and who would, when they travel, rather sweat in squalor than surrender the money to build a better terminal." And I thought that, you know, that attitude of not the government not participating in my food choices. I mean, all of the blowback when Bloomberg tried to bring a soda tax in, and all of the Republicans went crazy because the nanny state, it's this, it's that. And yet we did the same thing with smoking. Mm-hmm. We did the same thing with seatbelts. We did something of the same thing with alcohol, at least drunk driving. And so I don't understand why, you know, like it's kind of hard to imagine that in this political climate that we'll be able to force that.
Well, you've forgotten the fights over those things. Oh. There were fights over those things, and they were similar fights. They weren't as loud as they are now because we don't have the kind of, we had a bipartisan government in those days in which you could at least find some Republicans who were willing to invest in public health, and invest in common infrastructure for the general population. You know, rich people have private planes; they don't have to take trains.
You know, or they have their own car.
I mean, I was thinking about what coming back from Europe and spending 2 weeks in Europe, taking trains everywhere, and getting off the plane at Kennedy Airport, where's my train to go into Midtown Manhattan? Where is it? It doesn't exist. I mean, it does exist, but it's amazingly inconvenient.
It's completely inefficient.
Yeah, you have to go to Jamaica, and then you change, and you take the Long Island Railroad.
Nightmare.
I mean, it's totally...
It's the same out to Newark, which is only slightly easier.
Right.
Yeah.
It's in both cases. And so here you have this enormous city and no easy way to get to airports. And this is very unusual when in Milan you get off the plane, you get on a train, and you get off in a railway station that's across the street from your very nice hotel.
Right. It's the same in London as well. Yeah. You ride from Heathrow right into the center of the city.
Exactly.
You're either at Victoria or whatever, you know, whatever train station it is. So I guess my question about, you know, sort of trying to attain the American diet through some kind of government intervention, do you imagine, like, especially given what we were talking about funding members of Congress, the Citizens United, the McCutcheon, all of those factors, I'm just like not seeing where the population, where the public health is going to win over the corporate interests.
Oh, but it is winning.
You think it's winning?
I know.
People who have the happy.
Yeah, is winning. I mean, if you look at it from the grassroots level, more and more people are involved in the food movement.
Yes, that's true.
I mean, more and more people. So, and you can quantify it. You know, food in supermarkets is better. There are more farmers markets. There's more organic food being sold. People are drinking fewer sodas, and they're not making it up with other sugary drinks. Sugar is down. These are significant changes. People are eating less meat. These are significant changes.
Yes. And also we've seen the big changes in Tyson, Purdue announcing that they're withdrawing
and
antibiotics.
One company after another
reformulating
their food, taking the additives out. All of these are signs of grassroots bottom-up pressures that are really affecting change.
Yes.
So I'm enormously optimistic about what the food movement is doing. And that was part of my message for the United States Pavilion at Food Expo, is that there's a lot going on.
There is a lot going on. There is.
And Food Expo's part of it. Food Expo's about food.
Which is amazing in and of itself.
Which is amazing in and of itself. And that point is that this is, on an international basis, food is being taken seriously in a way that it never has before.
Interesting. Yeah, it is. And it's and so my next question to you, Marianne, is when will it become part of a political platform? That's what I'm curious about.
Oh, it's coming.
You think so?
It's coming. I don't know how soon, but it's
coming.
And
or who is going to be the exponent of that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I understand that there are people who are pushing the various candidates, but we don't know who the candidates are yet. So,
no.
Too early to tell.
Well, we do. We know that it'll be Hillary Clinton against, a ragtag mess of Republicans.
I'm not making any bets.
Hillary will get the nomination?
I have no idea. But nobody wants to take on food as an issue because it's so controversial. It is just so controversial. There isn't any aspect of it that doesn't get somebody upset.
Well, it gets people upset because their special interests are threatened by the change in the status quo. But the real black and white issues are black and white. Public health, is has an is being, I hate to, I don't want to use the word impact as a verb. I'm sorry, struggling not to use.
Affect.
Is being affected.
Is affect too
Thank
soft?
You. It's a little soft, but it's food choices or food products make an impact on public health.
Well, they certainly
and
do.
Until that becomes part of somebody's political platform, I just don't see.
Well, it's even more than that, because food affects the four most important issues in public health that we're dealing with: undernutrition or food insecurity, obesity and its health consequences, food safety, and the environmental impact of our agricultural system. And all of these would be made much better if we had less animal agriculture and more vegetable agriculture and supported it in accordingly. And that's where agricultural policy and health policy need to come together and haven't so far.
Yes.
Whether they will do so in this administration, I have no idea. I'm not betting on this Congress for anything.
Oh, I wish we could throw the whole lot of them out and
start
over. That
would be good.
Really, wouldn't it? So when after your soda book comes out, will you be writing the book about meshing agricultural and health policy together?
Well, I hadn't thought of it, but that's a very good idea.
I think it's a really good topic. I mean, who would do it better than you,
I'm
Marian?
Actually going to take a little hiatus, I think.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, this was a hard book to do.
Well, it was a tremendous amount of research.
And it's a very long book.
We have just a couple minutes, but give us a couple of highlights from the book. Tell us, what were the most astonishing things or the most, like...
Well, I think most astonishing thing was the astonishing, overwhelming, unbelievable lengths that soda companies go to sell their products.
Yeah.
And a lot of the book is about how soda companies market their products, not only through direct marketing, advertising, and the commercials that you see on television, but the ways in which behind the scenes they market to children, they market to minorities, they market to people overseas, they buy community groups by contributing to community fundraising. Mm-hmm. There is no organization too small to receive a grant from Coca-Cola or PepsiCo. PepsiCo is funding the U.S. Pavilion at the, and what did I just see? The Coca-Cola was doing something astonishing. Oh, and the American Beverage Association has now started, in connection with the Alliance for a Healthier Generation, that's the Clinton Initiative, they are now taking four communities in the Los Angeles area, and they're working on an anti-obesity program. The mind boggles. That's all I can say.
Fueled by Pepsi.
Fueled by Coca-Cola and Pepsi. It's the American Beverage Association. So I couldn't get over how comprehensive it was, how much lobbying on every single issue that could possibly affect the soda industry. The lobbying around the SNAP program so that nobody tries to take sodas out of SNAP. The minority chapter, I think, was one of the ones that really was really upsetting. The history is very complicated. And then a lot of the book is about advocacy and successful advocacy in dealing with soda companies, marketing issues, but also with the water issues and the environmental issues.
I was going to ask you about water.
And all of those. So there's chapters on all of these things, plus a number of advocacy case studies that show how advocacy works. And, of course, the big culmination of all of it was the Berkeley soda tax, which passed not only because Berkeley is Berkeley, but also because the Berkeley advocates for the soda tax did everything right. They did advocacy by the book. And that, it seems, and what I mean by that was they framed the issue not as a public health issue, but as Berkeley versus Big Soda.
Wow.
And that played really well.
Well, yeah, in Berkeley, I can see how that would happen.
And also, every time the soda industry tried to do something to oppose the tax, it was obvious that it was Big Soda exerting its muscle, and people could see right through it.
Right.
But the other thing they did was they did community organizing in a really serious and comprehensive way so that they canvassed in every single community in Berkeley and got out the vote in every single community. And that's what you have to do.
Yes.
if you're going to do advocacy and make it work.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on that note, we must say goodbye. You and I are not saying goodbye, but we will say goodbye to our listeners. Thank you so much, Marion.
My pleasure.
This was really a wonderful conversation. I so enjoyed this. Thank you to my sponsor, Kane Winery, and to my engineer, Jack Insley, as always. And we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening. Oh, 2 weeks from now. Have a great Memorial Day.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.